in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelans is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The United States has fully withdrawn its forces from Afghanistan to officially end 20 years of occupation. The invasion will be remembered for its colossal failures, unfulfilled promises, and a frantic final exit that cost the lives of scores of Afghan civilians and 13 U.S. military personnel. The final U.S. evacuation flight left Kabul Airport late on Monday. U.S. military officials say hundreds of Americans who have been left on Afghan soil will be transported out of the country in the coming days. A Taliban spokesman says the defeat of the United States in Afghanistan was a lesson for the invaders.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
More than 122,000 people have reportedly been evacuated from Kabul since August the 14th, the day before the Taliban took control of the country. U.S. President Joe Biden has come under immense criticism of his handling of the withdrawal. Nearly 90 retired U.S. generals and admirals have called for Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley to resign for their roles surrounding the chaotic pullout. The retired flag officers proposed what they felt should have happened in the withdrawal, including not rushing the pullout and not abandoning the Bagram airbase and American weapons and military equipment in the hands of the Taliban.
The war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again.
Well, I don't believe the U.S. government has learned a lesson. The U.S. media certainly hasn't learned a lesson. Statements we've seen from Biden, for instance, have been that we've accomplished our goals in Afghanistan, which I think is furthest from the truth.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks under the pretext of so-called war on terror. According to estimates, America's longest war took the lives of nearly 2,500 U.S. troops and an estimated 240,000 Afghans, and cost around $2 trillion U.S. dollars. Thousands of Afghan civilians were also maimed during the years. The estimated interest costs of the war are expected to top $6.5 trillion by 2050.
I think the U.S. went in there 20 years ago, removed the Taliban, and now the Taliban is back, perhaps stronger than ever. It seems like it's an utter defeat for the United States.
The war has left Afghanistan in ruins and devastated the country's infrastructure. Just as Saigon marked the humiliating defeat of U.S. geostrategic ambitions in Indochina after 10 years of war and conflict in Vietnam, many analysts now believe Kabul marks the same humiliating defeat in Central Asia.
You know, after the Vietnam War, there was something they called the Vietnam Syndrome. The American people didn't want to go into that kind of war ever again. And I believe we're seeing the beginning of an Afghan syndrome. The American people think it was a mistake, don't want to see it again. The trillions of dollars that went into Afghanistan could have been used to help the Afghani people or for the American people.
The botched military occupation is likely to trigger a refugee crisis in the Middle East and beyond. When it comes to Afghanistan and the wider region, Washington and its allies have proved after two decades that they have nothing to offer but misery and despair. U.S. officials believed that a U.S.-trained, funded, and equipped Afghan army could hold the line against the poorly trained, funded, and equipped Taliban insurgency. But after a 20-year presence in Afghanistan, they still had little or no understanding of Afghan society and the power of Taliban militants.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamadi. Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. Welcome to today's brand new episode of Youth Station. We're coming to you not live from IRB English Radio, and in the studio with me, I have my brother in faith and humanity and co-host in the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRB English Radio, and you are listening to the Youth Show. And I am your co-host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
What's our topic for today?
Okay, we need to clarify something first.
Sure, that's what we're here for.
Yeah. How old are you, Sayyid?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm 38.
Okay, there we go. You've already chosen
the... How old are you?
Besides the
point. No, how old are you? Let's clarify
that
too.
I'm in my 20s.
Early 20s, mid-20s, late-20s.
Mid-tour.
No, you're 29. You're going to be 30 in a few months. In 2 months, actually. Oh, a month. So, does that classify you as a youth person? All right, let's move on.
By that, I mean that you have chosen, to a great extent, the course of your life, right? Mm. You have defined for yourself what your priorities are, what are your goals and your objectives. You've selected the paths and methods through which you want to reach those set goals and objectives,
sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
In comparison with a lot of youth who could be listening to us, they could be teens, they could be in their early 20s, and they have yet to discover their capacities, their likes and dislikes, and the path they want to choose for their future. So I would really appreciate it if the approach we could take to the following discussions would be one of...
You
sharing your experience with us.
Put yourself in their shoe.
Yeah,
well.
Exactly. Or go back to how you were back then and share with us your experience through your wild days when you were but a simple goofball.
Yeah, but the thing is, you got to keep in mind that today, the youth and us, doesn't matter how old you are, we pretty much do the same stuff.
Supposedly, as a youth, mm-hmm. living in a non-Islamic country, you have that experience. Okay, good. A youth wants to choose their religion at some point in their lives,
mm-hmm.
right? And it clashes with the belief system of their family or close friends.
Yeah.
That's a huge problem.
It is.
Why do you think it's a problem, though? I have my reasons. What are your reasons?
I haven't had that experience myself of being in a family where my parents are not same faith as me. Alhamdulillah,
yeah, yeah.
I raised in a Muslim family, but I had a lot of experience with youth who lived in this environment.
Mm.
So I got a lot of examples I can share with you. For example, the first case I came through, this young boy, he's from a Christian family.
Mm.
He became a Muslim and he became a Shia Muslim, right? And then considering that the country that he came from, they take their religion really seriously. Right? Mm. Now, I don't want to mention the name of the country, but they are hardcore Christians that if their son
converts to another religion, all hell breaks
loose. That not just they will denounce him, they will kick him out of the house. And he's only 16, 17,
oh,
so
baby.
He can't go nowhere. So he can't tell them he can't practice what he has, so he had to keep it as a secret to himself. So it's very, very difficult.
It's like being Spider-Man.
It is.
Right? It's like being a superhero and having like dual identities, one of which you have to hide from your family and your friends.
However, that case is over 20 years ago.
Right. That makes it harder, though.
Okay. Yeah. So back in the day, because the world itself was very close to itself, so we had no social media, the internet was just at the beginning. You know, people weren't open to other cultures. They weren't open to other civilizations and so on and so forth and other cultures. Now,
true.
People are more open. Like, with the...
They're more exposed. We can't necessarily say they are more open.
If you pay attention to the media...
Because racists are still racist. Prejudice are still prejudice. Biased bigots are still biased bigots. They're just more exposed.
Yeah. However, the point I want to raise here... For example, with the influence of the media, and for example, most parents now, and then especially the new generations, I've said this guy, he was 15 back then, now he's going to be almost...
Oh, now he's almost as old as you are.
As old as me, right? Now, the problem is here, not a problem, actually the good thing is here, now with the media, it kind of done a lot of brainwashing that, you know what, you need to accept your child for where he is. If he is homosexual... You need to accept him. If he's an atheist, you need to accept him. There's a good and a bad, right? So this is a double-edged sword.
All right, we'll leave that we'll leave that part of the discussion for after the break. We're going to be right back. Don't you go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
You're back here on Youth Station with me, Zainab, and my co-host, Said Abdullah. Thank you so very much for joining us again. We've been talking about the struggles of a youth trying to find their spiritual path early on in life, while the path that they have chosen for themselves could, in some form or way, clash with that of their friends, close friends and family members, right? I can't necessarily say that I've experienced that myself firsthand. I did live in a society that were, you know, believed in different stuff than I did, but my family, but like you said, friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard.
It is hard.
I've
no
had them
being easy,
disowned.
Friends,
I have been then like
one's family
their parents
hard.
Threatening to kill them and stuff like that. Some really hardcore, nonsensical stuff. But you were talking about what the media has been doing these past few years. I'd say like this past decade, maybe.
Yeah, more than a few years. Past decade. Or maybe
about
even more.
Accepting our children for what they are.
Mm-hmm.
You said it as if it's like you have a problem with it. What's the problem with accepting
so
children?
No, sometimes your intention, your niya, makes a difference, right? So when the West and Hollywood concentrate so heavily and they invest so much money on the idea that a parent needs to accept his child for where he is, they're not saying, well,
they just
you know
do
what?
That so that they can push the LGBTQ propaganda.
Exactly. So they're putting that agenda, and they're putting the atheism agenda as well.
Yeah.
Right? So, for example, lately I was watching a show where the child is an atheist, the father is a minister, and they have this clash, and then they have to come they have to convince the father to come to term. Even though he's a minister and a priest, he has to accept his child for where he is, for his beliefs. And so they make it dramatic, they make it emotional. So that's the bad side of things. We're saying, yes, the notion that parents need to accept, if it's done for the right purpose, we have no problem. But if it's done in a purpose and the idea is just to corrupt the minds,
for
obviously
sure.
That's where we stand. That's why I said, if you remember, I said it's a double-edged sword. This agenda is being pushed. We have to look at it from either positive side or negative side. It could go both ways. But nevertheless, the idea is that a lot of these youth who live in Western countries, it depends on the country itself and the culture they come from. Sometimes it's accepting, sometimes it's not accepting. For example, you know, they might fight, like one of the cases, a 15-year-old girl, she called me once and she converted to Islam. And
how do these kids even, you know, how do they, the bigger question on my mind is how do they reach such a milestone so early on in their lives?
Because now with the media and social media, the whole world is open to them, and they watch a lot of things.
Exactly. It's
well,
what we it go we Two. Go back to that point yeah. that I made, which is exposure.
Yeah, so exposure is one thing. The second thing, they now they pretty much you have Muslims everywhere. So this particular girl, she fell in love with a Muslim boy.
Aww.
And he says, well, I'm a Muslim. We can't do this unless there's a contract, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, so what is Islam? What is this? One thing led to another.
And she was
so
enlightened.
She accepted Islam.
Beautiful.
So sometimes that exposure to media itself or to people, mashallah, we have Muslims in every part of the world now, in every corner of the world.
Is that a good
Muslims.
Thing, though?
It is a good thing.
Because they're mostly immigrants. They're not original, like, natives of that country.
Yes, but generation-wise, I mean, you know, like, for example,
no, because
where
see,
I
see,
come from, we have, like, fifth generation Australian
Muslims. Yeah, but
Muslims.
Is the fifth generation still firmly believing, practicing Muslim?
Some are, some are not.
Do you think they would be firmly believing, practicing Muslims had they stayed in their... Oh, actually, maybe they would have been dead if they stayed in their own country. You know, I still have mixed feelings about this whole immigration
Anyway, that's one of the topics later on we can discuss. The idea I was trying to get at is that this lady, she had...
She's not even a lady. She's a little child.
This little child. Call her what you like. She was able to speak to her parents, like, Mom, Dad.
Where were they from?
Australia.
Ah, okay.
They're pure Aussies. Dad, I'm a Muslim.
Well, Australians are very tolerant. Most of them, because they have a very diverse community.
Yeah. So when we look at this case, she said to them, look, I'm a Muslim. They said to her, look, we can accept you for who you are. You keep your faith outside the door.
Understandable.
Okay. We don't want to see hijab. We don't want to see salah. We don't want to see nothing. Right? So she tells me that when it's time to pray, she goes to the bathroom and she prays in the bathroom.
Why can't she pray in her bedroom?
Because they said to her, you know, she's afraid that someone might walk into her and see
her. Lock the door. It's totally cool in a Western society for a teen to lock her door.
It is, but I don't know her circumstances to be precise.
She could go pray at the...
She raised a very important fiqh issue as well. She said, well, it's the house. The house belongs to my parents.
Yeah.
They don't allow salah in it. So if I pray on that house, my
go pray outside. There are
yeah.
like
so that's
and
exactly that's what I said to
over.
Her. I said you can go to the park. You can, you know. Anyway, so we were trying to work out solutions. But the idea I'm trying to get at the parents themselves. They said, "Look, I can accept your faith, but keep it outside. Accept it for you are." And some cases, no, completely. You are a Muslim. You.
What would you? No, let's turn the tables around a little on this, Sayyid. Mm. What would you do? If your
child had to become an atheist,
you had
for example,
one. Do you have children?
I had children.
Okay,
yes.
Cool. May Allah bless and protect them. Amen. Your child comes up to you and says, "Yo, Dad, I'm gonna be Christian now, or I'm gonna be Jew now."
Yeah.
What? How would your reaction
I
be?
My reaction would be very normal. I will just go from the Quran's perspective. قُلْ هَاتُوا بُرْهَانَكُمْ كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. Give me evidence if you're truthful. So I would have a normal discussion with my child. Okay, you want to be an atheist, you want to be a Christian, why?
Would you? No. I mean, I'm saying, okay,
would I
fine.
Kick them out, right? Outcast them and then put a cross on them? Of course not.
And then tell them that, you can come to my house but leave your cross.
No, of course not.
Your crucifix or whatever outside the door.
No, there are...
I don't want any mentions of the Father, the Son, and
the Holy Spirit
in my house.
See,
we'll
one of my brothers...
Actually, no, let's not ever have to say that.
One of my brothers, let me give this example. One of my brothers, he's a Muslim Shia, right? But my brother, he's 95% atheist.
Wait.
And my father's a scholar with the imam on.
No. Say it. Make up your mind. Is Shia Muslim or is he an atheist?
He's a Shia Muslim by name, but his mindset is an atheist set.
All right.
Right? And he's questioning everything. So he said to my dad, and my dad is a scholar himself, Dad said to him with cool blood, I will just have to apply the Islamic laws to you. So it depends on the father and how he looks at it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. I wish we could discuss it more. There are still points that we need to touch upon, but maybe in the future. Thank you so very much for being with us, you guys. And until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am. Because you made, I have what I have. My love is strong. Because you are the one I call Creator, my Alpha and Omega.
defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Now where when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden is trying to ensure that an ongoing response to the suspicious events of 11th of September 2001 is not the major cause of U.S. action abroad. We now present you an article written by Andrew Mumford, an associate professor of politics and international relations at the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom. The piece is titled Joe Biden and the Future of America's Foreign Policy. The article has been taken from the Conversation website. As the last U.S. occupation forces leave Afghanistan, Joe Biden's decision to press ahead with the American withdrawal has prompted the first major foreign policy crisis of his presidency. The harrowing pictures after the bombing attack at Kabul airport were the result of a desire on behalf of President Biden to draw a line under a war he never truly believed in and shift the direction of U.S. foreign policy away from under the long shadow of the so-called War on Terror, as it nears its 20th anniversary. In short, President Biden is trying to ensure that an ongoing response to the suspicious events of 11th of September 2001 is not the major cause of U.S. action abroad. The U.S. president has been rightly criticized for presiding over an ill-thought-through pullout that took international allies and the Afghan people themselves by surprise. But the logic behind his decision rests on his long-standing belief that the war in Afghanistan was never winnable. As foreign policy analyst Edward Luce put it, there is no elegant way to quit a war you have lost. The United States has poured $1 trillion into training the Afghan National Army over nearly two decades. Successive administrations have been frustrated by the levels of incompetence and corruption at the heart of Afghan politics, which was established by the United States itself. Mindful of this and aware of the overwhelming historical record that demonstrates Afghanistan's imperviousness towards the imposition of external military rule, Joe Biden decided that enough was enough. Of course, Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, originally signed a deal with the Taliban in February of 2020 that had agreed to the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Afghanistan. Yet in order to understand why Biden went ahead with this deal, we must understand two things. Firstly, his track record opposing many key elements of the war in Afghanistan. And secondly, the wider foreign policy overhaul he's trying to engender. When asked in 2014 when he felt his vice president's greatest impact had been, Barack Obama replied, "On the foreign policy front, I think Joe's biggest influence was in the Afghanistan debate." Just a week before their inauguration in January of 2008, President-elect Barack Obama sent Joe Biden on a fact-finding mission to Afghanistan to assess the state of the war the new administration was going to inherit. Biden immediately became the in-house pessimist on Afghanistan and sought ways to minimize American involvement. After receiving commanding officer General Stanley McChrystal's request for additional troops in Afghanistan in August of 2009, Barack Obama spent the next 2 months chairing 10 formal meetings in which key members of the administration, including Vice President Joe Biden, discussed a review of the Afghan war strategy. In these meetings, Biden received the active encouragement of Barack Obama to argue the case for an overt counterterrorism approach to Afghanistan. This emphasized the targeted killing of Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders. It contrasted with the counterinsurgency option preferred by Obama's Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, and the Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, which emphasized the purported nation-building as a prelude to a reduction in violence. Joe Biden and Robert Gates clashed repeatedly over Afghanistan, especially over the need to inject a surge of troops into the country, which Biden opposed. Yet this was an argument Biden lost. Barack Obama set the course for a surge in Afghanistan of 30,000 additional troops in 2009. Yet this did not stop Biden from continuing to question the progress being made. The following year, Joe Biden publicly stated that the United States would be totally out of Afghanistan by 2014. This prompted Robert Gates to accuse Biden of disloyalty by actively working to show that the president had been wrong and that the war on the ground was going from bad to worse. All of this reveals a mindset that, according to one of his former policy advisors, Biden has consistently, since at least 2008, believed that the United States was throwing good money after bad in Afghanistan. This withdrawal may be shocking, but it is not a surprise if we look at Joe Biden's consistent skepticism towards the Afghanistan war. By withdrawing from Afghanistan, Biden has firmly pressed the reset button on U.S. foreign policy. He is keen to show that the so-called War on Terror era, as established by George W. Bush in the wake of the suspicious 9/11 attacks, is now truly over. Biden has no patience for open-ended and so-called nation-building exercises undertaken by U.S. occupation forces prosecuting counterinsurgency operations. His mission is to supposedly recalibrate foreign policy priorities for the century ahead and break free of a response to a terrorist attack from 20 years ago. Of course, terrorists will still threaten U.S. national interests, including the Daesh Takfiri terrorists inside Afghanistan, whose hitherto fractious relationship with the Taliban may develop into something more mutually beneficial. On the other hand, as the Kabul airport attack demonstrates, it could prove to be an unruly actor independent of Taliban control. The capacity for Daesh to capitalize on the situation is big. Future Taliban-Daesh relations will be of huge significance for the future of Afghanistan. But the focus on violent non-state actors has now been displaced in the broader realm of international relations by the return of great power politics. Responding to the military and political fallout from the rise of some big powers is now the only game in Biden's town. Indeed, the U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris undertook a tour of Asia while the Kabul crisis was unfolding, during which she ramped up the rhetoric on China. The direction of travel for American foreign policy for the next few years is already clear to see. Joe Biden's old sparring partner on Afghanistan, Bob Gates, famously took a swipe at the president in his memoirs for being wrong on nearly every major foreign policy and national security issue over the past four decades.
diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Blood gained victory over the sword on the day of Ashura because of Zainab. April 21st, 2010. Zainab al-Kubra is a prominent role model in history and shows the significance of a woman's presence in one of the most important events in human history. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. This was because the forces of righteousness were apparently defeated in a military fight in Karbala, but Zainab al-Kubra's behavior was the factor that turned this apparent defeat into a permanent and decisive victory. That victory was due to the role she played after the day of Ashura. But Zainab al-Kubra is a recent example and does not belong to ancient times. The story of her life is a tangible event. She played a brilliant role making the enemies who had apparently won the battle and slain all their opponents feel humiliated in their own base. She branded them with permanent disgrace and turned their victory into a defeat. Today the name of Hussein ibn Ali shines like the sun.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latshan, ana
latshan. Today the name of Hussein ibn Ali shines like the sun. February 17th, 2010. On the day of Karbala, Hussein ibn Ali and his companions were martyred in an abandoned desert where there was not any friend and where there were many enemies. On that day, his family members were taken captive, and that was over. Today, this event, which should normally have been destroyed and consigned to oblivion after 10, 15 days, is still prominent, even after the passage of many centuries. The name of Hussein ibn Ali is shining like the sun, and it is enlightening hearts and offering guidance, not only among millions of Shias and other Muslims in different Islamic countries, but also among non-Muslims.
In the limelight.
Mike Ryan, director of the World Health Organization's Health Emergency Program, recently compared booster shots to handing out life jackets to people already wearing them. The World Health Organization has been unusually vocal in its opposition to third vaccine shots by calling for a moratorium until the vaccine gap between rich and poor countries closes. We'll prepare for you an article written by Joseph Dana, a senior editor at Exponential View, a weekly newsletter about technology and its impact on society. The piece is titled Booster Shots Won't Stop the Next COVID-19 Variant. The article has been taken from the Syndication Bureau website. Delta variant of the COVID-19 is wreaking havoc around the world, and wealthy countries are deploying booster shots as a defense. The United States has pushed forward a plan to offer a third vaccination as an attempt to curb the spread within its borders. This response is hardly surprising, but given how many countries are still struggling to get a single dose of the vaccine to a significant segment of their populations, the move ignores the long-term threat from vast global disparities in immunity. Plus the emergence of the Mu variant, and behind it, C.1.2, further calls into question the prudence of booster vaccine shots. The best strategy for eradicating the Delta variant and the other variants waiting in the wings isn't booster shots in rich countries, but a worldwide vaccination program that gets as many people as possible fully inoculated. Such a program should focus on local manufacturing of vaccines to ensure poorer countries are empowered by the ability to produce the vaccine shots. Mike Ryan, director of the World Health Organization's Health Emergency Program, recently compared booster shots to handing out life jackets to people already wearing them. The World Health Organization has been unusually vocal in its opposition to third vaccine shots by calling for a moratorium until the vaccine gap between rich and poor countries closes. The vaccine doses lined up as booster shots should be sent to countries where many have not even had a single shot of the vaccine. This is even more urgent considering most booster recipients already have enough protection to avoid hospitalization and death. American officials claim booster shots won't interfere with vaccination drives worldwide. Jeff Zients, the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, claimed the U.S. donates twice as many vaccine doses as it uses. But he fails to answer why it could not donate more by not promoting booster shots. Now that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has fully authorized the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine, the ratio Zients mentions is bound to change. The authorization prompted several large institutions from the U.S. Army to the government of New York State to pass vaccine mandates for their staff. coupled with the push for booster vaccine shots, the U.S. is about to embark on another massive vaccination drive that will last well into next year. Whatever wealthy countries say, a booster shot campaign is going to set back global vaccination. And given the mutation pattern of COVID-19, these gaps in vaccination around the globe virtually guarantee the rise of new variants of the virus. While the Mu variant is now established as a variant of interest, the C.1.2 variant is being closely monitored because it carries changes that have given some previous variants increased transmissibility. First detected in South Africa in May of this year, it has also been detected in 7 other countries in Africa, also in Europe, Asia, and Oceania. It is understandable that Western countries might rush to inoculate their populations fully instead of making decisions about other nations. However, this strategy is broken. We might think of defeating COVID-19 in war terms, but in truth, it is global cooperation that is vital for victory. Wealthier countries could use up all of the COVID-19 vaccines in existence, only to face a new variant that developed in an unvaccinated country. Thus, theoretically, those booster shots might have more impact if they were sent abroad. The most effective way to combat the Delta, Mu, and other variants of the coronavirus is to expand manufacturing capacity to regions where vaccination rates are low. We must overcome the dismal vaccine rollout in emerging markets to see if we can get a handle on new variants of the coronavirus. But this is easier said than done. Lost in the clouds of disinformation surrounding COVID are concerning statements about intellectual property laws and a vaccine. In April, American billionaire Bill Gates stated his opposition to expanding the manufacturing of the vaccine to developing nations because it would complicate vaccine trials, and most countries didn't have the technical capacity to manufacture these specialized vaccines. Not only is that line of thinking wrong, but it reveals one of the most uncomfortable realities about the vaccines. Pharmaceutical companies are eyeing their bottom lines more than thinking about how we can collectively put a stop to COVID variants. The recent news from South Africa, after the government struck a landmark deal with Johnson & Johnson to finish manufacturing vaccine doses in the country, the New York Times discovered that many locally finished doses of vaccines were being exported to the European Union. Over several months, the European Union received as many as 32 million doses of the vaccine from South Africa operation, even though countries across southern Africa desperately needed vaccine supplies. Johnson & Johnson was able to outsource a part of the manufacturing process to South Africa and then export the doses to Europe, which likely netted the company a handsome margin, since costs are relatively low in South Africa and European governments can pay a premium for the vaccines. For example, the situation in some regions is so bad that Taiwan began using its own domestically developed vaccine this month instead of waiting on global vaccines that haven't materialized. The Taiwanese government ordered 16 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine and Moderna vaccine earlier this year, but has only received 4 million doses so far. Let's be clear, a sudden shift in vaccine policy where Western countries refocus efforts on a genuinely global vaccination drive isn't going to defeat the pandemic by itself. By most accounts, we will have to deal with this virus for some years to come. But pulling the curtain back on the uneven vaccine deployment and resolving the reasons for this sad state of affairs can help us handle the next variant of the coronavirus and the pandemic. In this battle, cooperation is the most potent weapon we have.
the World with Reporters.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with 8 drones of Sammar 3 type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with 8 Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jizan, and Najran were also successfully hit by 5 ballistic missiles and 2 drones of Sammar 3 type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting Eastern Province as well as the cities of Najran and Jizan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think we should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States did in this country. It makes it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials, but I think as a global community we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs. He needs to take more refugees because these people are in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Among the 7 Iranian COVID vaccines, Covfars is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in 2 groups, one receiving Sinopharm and the other Razi Covfars. we are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, Kovpars authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that Kovpars will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
Kovpars is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. Kovpars says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months. As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, Kovpars developers say they've already launched their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali, Alborz Province.
Taliban have deployed more troops and military hardware to the northeastern Panjshir Valley to take the last remaining territory in Afghanistan from the National Resistance Front, headed by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Massoud has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if the narrow and mountainous valley is attacked. Meanwhile, some top political leaders urge both sides to set aside differences and resume a meaningful negotiation in a bid to avoid dangerous scenarios, mainly the loss of civilian lives in Panjshir, as well as a spread of armed resistance across the rest of provinces.
The only way of the ongoing situation in Panjshir is to simultaneously resume meaningful negotiations and continue resistance against any totalitarian policy to pave the way for establishment of an inclusive government.
This is while the expansion of war has forced hundreds of local villagers to flee their houses. They call on the international community and especially the UN to convince both sides to resume negotiations.
The war has forced us to flee our village and come to Kabul. I have 5 children. We have nowhere to go but city parks. We want peace. Our children should take up their education in a calm atmosphere. So I want Massoud and Taliban to stop their war machines.
The possible fall of Panjshir Valley into the hands of Taliban will bring the entire country under the rule of Taliban for the first time, as they couldn't capture Panjshir Valley during their first rule in Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. The war on Panjshir has turned into a big headache for the Taliban. Moreover, the group's leaders have so far failed to reach an agreement on the formation of the new government in Kabul. The Taliban have postponed the move again, saying they need more time for final consultations among the group's top leaders. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A high-level Lebanese ministerial and security delegation has arrived in Damascus. Deputy Prime Minister of the Lebanese caretaker government, Zeyna Akkar, who holds several other positions, headed the delegation, which included the ministers of energy and finance, as well as head of the General Directorate of General Security. They were welcomed by Syria's foreign minister at the Jdeideh Tiabous crossing. The delegation held talks with several Syrian officials at once at the foreign ministry, namely the Syrian ministers of foreign affairs, finance, and oil. Talks focused on economic cooperation and Lebanon's need of Syria's help in transferring gas for generating electricity.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living in, especially the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist.
Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and details of implementation through a joint technical team. Observers believe such a visit was only possible due to the U.S. backing of a plan that ensures Lebanon obtains gas.
I think Lebanon got a green light from the U.S. for such a visit. The Syrian government conveyed a message to the Lebanese side that it has accepted their request. I think the matter now is in the hands of Lebanon to get a regional and international approval for Syria's participation in pumping gas to Lebanon, as there are U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria.
Lebanon is seeking to revive a 2009 deal which stipulated that Egypt transfers millions of cubic meters of gas annually to Syria through Jordan, while Syria pumps the same amount to Lebanon. This is Lebanese officials' most significant visit to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. Lebanon, which remained relatively neutral towards Syria for so long, seems to have no other option now in light of its economic slowdown but to fully reactivate its cooperation and relations with Syria in hopes of some economic relief. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Streets remain deserted and business establishments closed in all major towns and the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir for the second day after the death of the region's veteran separatist leader, Syed Ali Gilani. Indian forces continued a strong presence to prevent anti-government protests and enforce a strict lockdown. The authorities had also imposed near-total communication blockade across Kashmir as a precautionary measure to maintain law and order. On Friday, additional deployments were made to prevent people from holding anti-government protests after the Friday prayers.
Gilani, the most powerful separatist leader in Kashmir who spent many years in different jails, died on Wednesday evening at his Srinagar residence, where he had remained incarcerated for the past decade.
As the news of his death spread far and wide, authorities swung into action and sealed the roads leading to Gilani's Haidarpura residence. Security was beefed up across the region, barricades erected, and key roads sealed, calling and internet services were shut. According to his family members, the former lawmaker, who after quitting electoral politics in late 1980s had for years spearheaded the separatist movement in Kashmir, had desired to be buried in Srinagar's historic martyrs' graveyard, but the family members alleged that police forcibly took away his body and in a quiet funeral buried him in a graveyard near his residence.
He passed away late evening. We live in his neighborhood. We were neither allowed to visit his residence to pay him last respect, not allowed to participate in his funeral sitting COVID. This is very unfortunate. It will hurt us forever.
We wanted to participate in the funeral procession of our leader, but we were not allowed by forces. He was hurriedly buried, and no one was allowed to say him the final goodbye. At least we should have been allowed to offer funeral prayers.
Known for his pro-Pakistan stance, Gilani led several anti-India protests and marches. He became a household name during 2008 and 2010 public uprising in Kashmir. A staunch advocate of Kashmir's right to self-determination, Gilani had stepped down as Hurriyat Conference chairman after he suffered with ailing health. He was conferred Pakistan's highest civilian honor in 2020. His death has been widely condoled, with Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan describing him as, quote, Mujahid-e-Kashmir. Meanwhile, police spokesman has said that there has been no incident of violence or protest in Kashmir after Gilani's death. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts. Sidli Safib, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A new major victory has been achieved by the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's oil-rich province of Marib. Yemen's armed forces have recaptured the strategic Rahba district in the southern Marib, meaning that